فعلي تمامه.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, a dead person will be questioned about five things: his prayer, his alms tax, zakat, his obligatory pilgrimage, hajj, his fasting, and his acceptance of our divine guardianship, wilaya, the Ahlul Bayt. Our guardianship will address the other four from inside the grave. Any deficiency that is in you, I will fill.
Welcome, O Ramadan. You are honored, O month of the Quran. It is Ramadan. O one who sleeps, stand up and declare the oneness of Allah, the oneness of Allah. O one who fasts, stand up in prayer at night, and Allah will forgive. Allah will forgive. Welcome, O Ramadan. You are honored, O month of the Quran. It is Ramadan.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden will withdraw American combat troops from Afghanistan by 11th of September, declaring an end to the nation's longest war and overruling warnings from his military advisors that the departure could prompt a resurgence of the same threats that sent hundreds of thousands of troops into combat over the past 20 years. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Helen Cooper, Thomas Gibbons Neff, and Eric Schmidt. The piece is titled, Biden to Withdraw All Combat Troops from Afghanistan by 11th of September. President Joe Biden will withdraw American combat forces from Afghanistan by 11th of September this year, declaring an end to the nation's longest war and overruling warnings from his military advisors that the departure could prompt a resurgence of the same threats that sent hundreds of thousands of troops into combat over the past 20 years. In rejecting the Pentagon's push to remain until Afghanistan security forces can assert themselves against the Taliban, Joe Biden forcibly stamped his views on a policy he has long debated but never controlled. Now, after years of arguing against an extended American military presence in Afghanistan, the president is doing things his way, with a deadline set for the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. A senior Biden administration official said the president had come to believe that a conditions-based approach would mean that American troops would never leave Afghanistan. President Biden's decision would pull all American troops out of Afghanistan some 20 years after former President George W. Bush ordered an invasion after the September 11 attacks on New York and the Pentagon. The war was launched with widespread international support, but it became the same long, bloody, unpopular slog that forced the British to withdraw from Afghanistan in the 19th century and the former Soviet Union to retreat in the 20th century. Nearly 2,400 American troops have died in Afghanistan in a conflict that has cost about $2 trillion. Mr. Biden's Democratic supporters in Congress praised the withdrawal, even as Republicans said it would risk American security. The United States went into Afghanistan in 2001 to defeat those who attacked the U.S. on 9/11, Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, said in a statement. It is now time to bring our troops home, maintain humanitarian and diplomatic support for a partner nation, and refocus American national security on the most pressing challenges we face. John Saltz, an Iraq War veteran and chairman of the progressive veterans group Vote Vets, said, "Words cannot adequately express how huge this is for troops and military families who have weathered deployment after deployment with no end in sight for the better part of 2 decades." President Biden's decision drew fire from Republicans. "This is a reckless and dangerous decision," said Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, the ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator Inhofe said, "Arbitrary deadlines would likely put our troops in danger, jeopardize all the progress we've made, and lead to civil war in Afghanistan, and create a breeding ground for international terrorists." Former President Donald J. Trump had set a withdrawal deadline for of 1st of May, but he was known for announcing and reversing a number of significant foreign policy decisions, and Pentagon officials continued to press for a delay. President Biden, who has long been skeptical of the Afghan deployment, spent his first 3 months in office assessing that timeline. "The Afghan central government is unable to halt Taliban advances, and American officials offer a grim assessment of prospects for peace in the country." Still, American intelligence agencies say they do not believe Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups pose an immediate threat to strike the United States from Afghanistan. That assessment has been critical to the Biden administration as it decided to withdraw most of the remaining U.S. forces from the country. A senior Biden administration official said the troop withdrawal would begin before 1st of May and conclude before the symbolic date of 11th of September. Any attacks on withdrawing NATO troops, the official said, would be met with a forceful response. Meanwhile, Taliban leaders have long pledged that any breach of the deadline means that their forces will again being attacking American and coalition troops. Under a withdrawal deal negotiated during the Trump administration, the Taliban mostly stopped these attacks, but in past weeks, they have rocketed American military bases in Afghanistan, particularly in the south and east of the country. In public statements on Tuesday, 13th of April, Taliban leaders focused not on President Biden's decision for a full withdrawal from Afghanistan, leaving behind a weak central government that has proved incapable of halting insurgent advances around the country, but rather on the fact that the Biden administration was going to miss the 1st of May deadline. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mojahed, speaking on local Afghan television, said, "We're not agreeing with the delay after the 1st of May. Any delay after 1st of May is not acceptable to us." The American-led war in Afghanistan was won and lost several times over the past 2 decades. The initial campaign, in which relatively small numbers of special operation forces partnered with local Afghan militias supported by American airstrikes, was quickly successful in forcing Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders to flee, mostly into neighboring Pakistan, by late 2001 and early 2002. Many military analysts praised the mission as a good example of planning and war fighting. But then the war evolved and expanded from a counter-terrorism mission to one devoted to nation building. But the inability to create effective local security forces in Afghanistan allowed the Taliban to stage a comeback, prompting a significant surge of foreign troops back into the country starting in 2009, an effort that effectively amounted to a second invasion of Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the Biden administration officials are saying that the United States would reposition American troops in the region to keep an eye on Afghanistan and the Taliban, and would hold the Taliban to a commitment that there would not be a re-emergence of a terrorist threat on American or Western interests from Afghanistan. But it was unclear what that meant or how far those repositioned forces would go to protect, for example, the fragile Afghan government or Afghanistan's national security forces. The Biden administration officials are saying that some troops would remain in the country to protect American diplomatic presence in Afghanistan, a standard practice. Joe Biden's top aides have said he's keenly aware of the risk of a total security collapse transpiring in Kabul, the Afghan capital, if all Western troops leave the country, and he has privately described a fall of Saigon scenario as haunting. But in private meetings in recent weeks, the president has also questioned whether the small remaining contingent of American forces can accomplish anything after 20 years, during which almost 800,000 U.S. troops have been deployed to Afghanistan, or whether it will ever be possible to bring them home. The cost for the war and reconstruction effort is estimated at about $2 trillion.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Activists in the U.S. has held rallies in Washington, D.C. to call for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The activists from the Yemeni Liberation Movement have been on hunger strike since March 29th to call on the U.S. government to cease support for Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and draw attention to the plight of millions of Yemenis facing malnutrition and starvation. The protesters say what they're going through doesn't compare with the pain experienced by war-weary Yemenis, but it can raise awareness about the dire humanitarian situation in the Arab nation.
So, as someone who's part of Yemeni Liberation Movement, we believe in self-determination. So for the people of Yemen to determine for themselves the way that they want to live. And they're not able right now to make those decisions because they're actively and violently being starved by the U.S. government and by the Saudi-UAE coalition.
Experts say the fact that a growing number of people in the U.S., including politicians, are now demanding an end to the years-long war is a positive development, but not enough to end the conflict.
Everybody can imagine just how much your health and well-being is impacted. And I do hope that those who are watching and seeing realize that the longer that you all are on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen.
But what steps can the international community take to ensure it can put an end to the deadly crisis? During his first foreign policy speech, U.S. President Joe Biden laid out his agenda for the Yemen conflict.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that the Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon. But even that couldn't stop Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. Although the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen escalated under former U.S. President Donald Trump with his administration's boundless support for the Saudis, the war began when Joe Biden was incumbent as a U.S. vice president in the Barack Obama administration.
I mean, I think Biden's silence speaks volumes, right? So since 2015, an administration that he was a part of, he's actively chosen billions and billions of dollars in weapon sales. Corporations have made billions and billions of dollars in sales, and they've decided that that money, right, is more important than the lives of Yemeni people. And it's more important than the child that dies every 75 seconds in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the National Salvation Government. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia is soon to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. Many observers believe that ending the war requires international pressure against Saudi Arabia and its regional allies, especially by their powerful partners, including the United States. But whether or not those nations' wider West Asia policies allow risking their ties with Riyadh is anybody's guess.
The latest round of talks on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, ended in Vienna on Friday. The Austrian capital hosted 4 days of talks between delegates from Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal to revitalize the agreement. The U.S. also sent a delegation to Vienna, but Iran rejected to hold direct or indirect talks with them. Tehran and Washington remain in a standoff as both sides call on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. While the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to rejoin the JCPOA, so far it has refused to remove sanctions. The U.S. says it is prepared to lift sanctions that are inconsistent with the JCPOA. While it has declined to elaborate, that appears to exclude sanctions formally related to nuclear issues covered by the deal. Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the 2015 nuclear accord. As the first round of negotiations finished on Friday, the participants agreed to hold another round of talks next Wednesday in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The negotiations are going to be about removal of sanctions and nuclear implementation of the deal.
We know that Trump's maximum pressure campaign failed against Iran. And Iran has emerged with an economy more resistant to external pressure and so insulated from the U.S. sanctions.
China has said the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally and remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman described the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from 2015 nuclear deal as the root cause of the crisis. During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA by calling it a weak agreement. Then Washington used the maximum pressure campaign to wage an economic war on Tehran to force it to renegotiate. The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif previously said that unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. inflicted $1 trillion worth of damage on Iran's economy. He said Iran expects compensation after Washington rejoins the accord. A senior U.S. State Department official has predicted if Tehran insists on the removal of all sanctions imposed since 2017, Washington will reach an impasse.
Iran, in the current situation, has limited the negotiations to only two expert committees. One is active and one is standby. The active expert committee is working to assess and present measures that the United States is needed to implement to be able to come back to the full compliance with the JCPOA.
Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. How could the U.S. want a mutual return while they withdrew from the deal and Iran is still part of it? It is clear that the U.S. will leave Vienna empty-handed if the outcome of the talks is anything but removal of all sanctions.
A research monitoring group on global arms sales has confirmed that the United States maintains its status as the world's biggest exporter of weapons, a title that Washington has held since the end of the Cold War. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, also referred to as SIPRI, found that between 2016 and 2020, around 47% of all U.S. arms exports went to American allies in the Middle East. That's a rise of 28% compared to the previous 5 years. In a report, it found that U.S. exports to North Africa had also witnessed a spike. Generally, global arms sales stabilized with the exception of the Middle East and North Africa. The research suggests these two destinations are lucrative markets for Western arms suppliers, despite the wars, the death and the destruction in the two regions. Analysts are left asking how Washington can talk of peace in Yemen, for example, while it is complicit in the killing of civilians there. Saudi Arabia made up 11% of the total arms import market worldwide and is the biggest importer of US, UK and Canadian arms. In February, U.S. President Joe Biden had claimed that Washington would end the relevant arms sales to Saudi Arabia that are being used in the kingdom's war on Yemen, which he referred to as offensive weapons. But arms controls advocates are not exactly celebrating. They are calling for more transparency. The Center for Civilians in Conflict says it's not quite clear yet where the administration will land on what weapons they deem to be offensive. The Washington-based NGO also says, "We've seen other sales that indicate the Biden administration may be staying the course on less high-profile but still very concerning arms sales." Just recently, the Biden administration had been condemned for approving a $197 million arms sale to Egypt, despite human rights concerns there. The SIPRI report also reveals that not only was the U.S. the largest exporter of weapons, but over the last 5 years, its global share of arms exports had increased from 32% to 37%. In contrast, Russian arms exports decreased by 22% during the same period. This has increased the gap between the two of the world's largest exporters of arms. The report also notes that the U.S. had supplied major arms to 96 countries, far more than any other nation. Saudi Arabia alone accounted for 24% of all U.S. arms sales. Analysts say conflicts such as the Saudi war on Yemen can quite easily come to an end if Washington halts its large arms exports. Critics also argue that by sending arms to conflict zones, the U.S. has put profits for its arms manufacturing companies over the lives of innocent civilians. Project South has described SIPRI's findings as deplorable. The advocacy group says the U.S. government specifically is willing to close its eyes on the atrocities committed by governments if they are reliable importers of U.S.-made war-making machines. It added that, instead of supporting peace, the global north continues the colonial tradition of war-making. This also explains the lack of concrete action on the systematic human rights abuses of countries such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Rights groups have heavily criticized America's long-standing warm ties with dictatorships in West Asia. They argue that despite these regimes waging war on other countries and despite their terrible rights record, the lucrative arms trade appears to come first for Washington. Peace advocates also argue that as the arms exports allow conflicts to drag on and on, American arms manufacturers count their ever-expanding profits over an ever-expanding list of dead women and children.
The government in Baghdad is under pressure from the parliament and many political groups to force out the remaining U.S. troops in Iraq. Calls for the withdrawal of all American troops have been growing louder amid rising anti-U.S. sentiments across Iraq. There have been popular demonstrations against the presence of foreign troops on Iraqi soil. Meanwhile, U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq have come under a growing number of attacks over the past months. It's been proving more difficult to protect foreign troops who have defied the calls to leave. This week, Baghdad and Washington agreed on the withdrawal of all remaining U.S. and coalition combat troops from Iraq. The two sides issued a statement saying that the agreement was reached following their first strategic dialogue under U.S. President Joe Biden. But this week's agreement does not mean that the mission of U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq is over. They will still provide training and assistance to Iraqi armed forces. The Iraqi army says it will set up a committee that would hold technical talks with the U.S. to draw up mechanisms and timings related to the redeployment. How will political parties and resistance groups react to this week's announcement? Critics have questioned the agreement, arguing that Baghdad could find it difficult to sell the new arrangement to the Iraqi people and political groups.
I think the U.S. has no intention to really leave Iraq or the region. I think they will make one pretense after another, one negotiation after another, one renaming of the troops that they have in country, but I don't think they plan to leave.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. The anti-Americanism was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attacks on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces. But America is still refusing to heed that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safer, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, the U.S. withdrew several hundreds of its forces from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite repeated pledges to end American military presence in the region. The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from former U.S. President Donald Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Since we are in the month of Ramadan, we are going to, in fact, hover around the questions around fasting and Ramadan, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hausa studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtadha Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij in his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and our dear guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, since we are in the month of Ramadan, let's begin with a general description of what it is that we call fasting. What does it mean to fast, according to Ayatollah Khamenei?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم there's a verse in the Quran which says بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا كتب عليكم الصيام كما كتب على الذين من قبلكم لعلكم تتقون. Fasting means that a person must, in obedience to the commands of Allah, avoid. Fasting means that a person must, in obedience to the command of Allah, avoid certain things. And of course, we will talk about those things which invalidate the fast, mm-hmm. and which a person must avoid. But real fasting is not about avoiding food and drink only. The goal of fasting is to achieve taqwa and to achieve piety and God consciousness. Because the verse says لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ means that hopefully you will achieve and gain taqwa or God consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the goal of fasting. So we have to fast and we have to observe fast in obedience to the command of Allah.
Yes.
In the hope of achieving proximity to Allah and closeness to Allah, achieving God consciousness, achieving piety. These are the goals of fasting, okay?
Yes.
So fasting is not only about not eating and not drinking, okay? There are certain things which we must avoid during fasting, because those are the things which we must stay away, okay? If we do not stay away from those things, then the fast is not valid. So
basically, fasting is not only for the stomach.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
The other parts of the body are also involved, and there are certain ritual acts that needs to be observed.
Sure, of course. Our eyes must fast. Our tongue, our hands, okay? We should not do anything anything which is haram, which is illicit, which is unlawful.
Yes.
And we should not gaze at, for example, at things which are haram, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So every element of our body should observe fast and should actually stay away from things which are haram.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Javid, we all know that fasting, according to what you said, especially which has been transcribed in the Holy Quran, fasting is obligatory, right?
Yeah.
From dawn to dusk or dawn to sunset or to Maghrib.
Yes.
What is the difference between sunset and Maghrib?
Of course, there is a clear difference between sunset and Maghrib. Of course, sunset and Maghrib are two words which are interchangeably used, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Especially by Sunni Muslims, because there's no difference. For the Sunni Muslims, there's no difference between sunset and Maghrib. Sunset for them is the same as Maghrib, and that's the time they have to break their fast. They should start offering their prayers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But for us, there's a difference between sunset and Maghrib. Sunset is the time when the sun actually begins to hide behind the in the horizon,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Yes.
But the rays of the sun might still be visible in the sky. That's not the time when we should break our fast, or that's not the time when we should start offering our prayers. So there is a clear difference between sunset and Maghrib. Maghrib is the time when it has become dark. And of course, the proper word we can use for Maghrib is dusk, okay?
Yes.
It's dusk,
yes.
Not sunset, okay?
Uh-huh.
The dusk is the time when darkness...
dark.
Yeah, when darkness is visible around you, and you can see that there's no sun ray in the sky or in the horizon,
especially in the west.
Yeah, in the west. And of course, we will discuss when it comes to the timing for iftar. Okay, there is a difference between the time when we are allowed to break our fast, and the time when the Sunnis and Sunni Muslims, of course, break their fast. Shia Muslims should not break their fast in their timing,
mm-hmm.
and inshallah we will come to it.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Sheikh Javid, does the same difference between sunset and dusk, as you mentioned, or Maghrib, apply to sunrise, and also if there is another term for it?
Well, sunrise, we don't have any difference between Shia Sunni Muslims when it comes to sunrise, okay?
Uh-huh.
When the sun rises, that's the end of the prayer time, but it's not the start of the fasting. It's not the...
So you mean sunrise is the same as dawn?
No.
But sunset is not the same as sun.
No. Sunrise is not the same as dawn, okay?
Okay.
Sunrise is actually 1 hour and 30 minutes after dawn, okay?
Uh-huh.
That's when the sun can be seen in the sky, or its rays can be seen. And when the sun is about to rise up in the horizon, it can be seen, okay? That's the time we call sunrise, okay? But dawn, when we speak about dawn, we mean the true dawn, when the horizon, whiteness begins to spread in the eastern part of the horizon, there's whiteness. But of course, that whiteness cannot be seen in the city, because there are a lot of okay?
Tall buildings.
Tall buildings, lamps. And
trees,
lights. Lights are there, which prevent visibility.
I see. Okay?
And so, but in rural areas, when there's, and places where there's no light, you can see that at dawn time, the whiteness begins to spread, and that is when you should stop eating and drinking, and that's the time when you can say the adhan, or when the call for prayer is can be said, and when you can start offering your prayers.
Uh-huh. But the sunrise usually comes like about 1 hour,
one and a half hour. Yes.
After that. After dawn.
After dawn. Yes.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay. A very quick question. Remaining the difference between the Shias and Sunnis, can a Shia Muslim break his fast along with the Sunni Muslims?
Yes, yeah, that's the question I really anticipated, and we can discuss it. Of course, a lot of Shia Muslims are under the impression that they can break their fast along with Sunnis to show their unity with them, to show solidarity. Or to express their solidarity with the Sunni Muslims. And they think that that's the time when they can break their fast, but that's not the case, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of ways to show your solidarity with Sunni Muslims, and of course, we support solidarity in every sense of the word. But fasting is something you should actually
act according to your own school.
Yeah, according to your own school, according to the fatwa of your own jurisprudent or maja, okay? And generally speaking, Shia Muslims should break their fast some 12 or 30 minutes after the Sunni timing, okay?
Yes.
After the Sunni. They have to wait until they are sure, until they are sure that the time has set in. And then they can break their fast. And as long as they are not sure, they should not break their fast. They should not break their fast, okay? So this is one of the most frequently asked questions. People in the West, people in Sunni-dominated or predominantly Sunni-populated countries ask this question a lot, and they want to know whether it is permissible or not. Of course, it's not permissible to break your fast in their timing, okay? You should wait until you're confident, until you're certain the time has set in, and then you can break your fast.
Thank you very much. There are many more questions that I hopefully, God willing, we'll ask you in the next episodes to come. Thank you very much for accepting our offer and coming to the studio and shedding some light on these questions related to this special holy month of Ramadan. If there is a cream of the crop for everything, if there is a bride for everything, I guess that Ramadan is the cream of the crop, the bride of all months that there are to it in these 12 months. So please keep us in your du'as, especially in this holy month. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya ayyuhallazina amanu kutiba alaykumus.
O you have faith, prescribed for you is fasting as it was prescribed for those who were before you, so that you may be God-weary.
رمضان زمان الحسنات
رمضان زمان البركات
رمضان زمان الحسنات
رمضان زمان البركات
رمضان مجان الصلوات تسمو بالنفس بمولاها
رمضان مجان الصلوات
تسمو بالنفس بمولاها.
Thank you.
the early hours of March 11, 2012, a person dressed in Afghan clothes entered the American military's Camp Belambai, located in Afghanistan's Kandahar. He took off his Afghan clothes, which he was wearing over his U.S. military uniform, put his weapon on the ground, raised his hand as a sign of surrender, and uttered three words, "I did it." The next day, it was found that many people were killed in two nearby villages of Al-Khazai and Balandi. 16 people dead, including 9 children, in addition to 6 people injured. The murderer was the same soldier who had confessed, Robert Bales. The U.S. camp's guards, and also the Afghan guard, had witnessed that on the morning of March 11th, an American soldier wearing night vision goggles and Afghan clothes over his military uniform had left the camp. The Afghan guard reported that the person had returned to the camp at 1 a.m. and again left the camp at 2:30 a.m. Bales first went to Al-Khazai, located half a mile north of Camp Belambai, and then, in the next step, he went to Balandi, located 1.5 miles south of the camp, and killed many of the two villages' inhabitants. In Al-Khazai, 4 members of a family were killed. According to a testimony by a 16-year-old boy who was shot in the thigh, Bales first woke his family up and then murdered them. Bales went to Balandi an hour later, opened the door of the home of a villager named Muhammad Dawood, and murdered him by shooting him in the head. He then entered Abdul Samad's home and murdered 11 members of his family, including his wife, 4 daughters, and 2 of his relatives. Then he confronted his 4 sons, who were between the ages of 8 and 12. He caught them by the hair, dragged them over the floor, and murdered them by shooting them in the head. All the victims were first shot in the head and then stabbed with a knife to be made sure they were dead. Bales then gathered their corpses in a room and burnt them. The next day, only ashes remained of the 11 people, as well as the half-burned corpse of a child. U.S. authorities apologized for the Kandahar killings and announced that the massacre had been carried out by Bales and that they will put him on trial. The Afghan government condemned the incident as well. On March 15, 2012, the Afghan Parliament's probe team started an investigation about the murders. The main issue was that how one soldier could have been able to carry out such killings during one night at 2 different villages. The investigation continued for 2 days, while interviews with the survivors and people of the area revealed new dimensions of the issue. Neighbors and family members of the murdered individuals did not confirm that only one soldier was behind the attacks. Rather, they regarded a group of American soldiers as perpetrators of the murders. One of the women of the villages, who is a mother of 6 children and lost her husband in the massacre, said nearly 20 soldiers attacked their village and killed her husband and threatened her, telling her not to leave the house or they'd kill her too. An 8-year-old girl called Noor Binak, who lost her father in the shootings, said one of the soldiers entered their room and killed her father while the others were standing in the yard. Other witnesses also testified, confirming the high number of soldiers, until Hamid Karzai, the then president of Afghanistan, appointed General Mohammad Karimi to further investigate the issue. In the end, the Afghan Parliament's probe team concluded that nearly 20 American soldiers were involved in the murders in Al-Khazai and Balandi villages. A member of the probe team, Hamizai Lali, said that given the distance between the American military camp and the two villages, and also interviews with people of the area, it was not possible for one soldier to kill so many people, especially in an hour.
We believe it is not possible for one person to do that. In his family, in four rooms, people were killed. Children and women were killed. And then they were all brought together in one room and then put on fire. That one man cannot.
As representative of the probe team, Lali asked the Afghan government and the United Nations to ensure that the perpetrators were put on trial in Afghanistan. But then U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said Bales will be put on trial according to American military laws. The U.S. military flew Bales out of Afghanistan to Kuwait on March 14, 2012. Then, on March 16th, he was moved to the Midwest Joint Regional Correctional Facility in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
We strongly demand and strongly ask the United States that the justice should be applied and trial should be based on the principles of fair trial and provide opportunities and time to the to victim families and members to be represented and to be heard in the court of the United States there.
Afghan people and the families of victims deserve a proper justice to be done.
No other person except for Bales was found guilty by the U.S. military, and the military still insisted that the massacre was not done by a group. On August 23, 2013, Bales was sentenced to life in prison for 16 counts of premeditated murder.
A life sentence to him or a death sentence to him will not bring back our children that he killed. Will not bring back the happiness of those families. And will not replace the loss that the Afghan nation suffered. We are more in trying to bring an end to the sufferings of the Afghan people.
In order for the incident to be forgotten, the U.S. paid the victims' families a total of $860,000. The U.S. military's Camp Belambai in Kandahar continued its activities without any change, and the soldiers present in the massacre were never identified and put on trial. IRIB English Radio.